Maine has long been a place where people find satisfaction in self-reliance, growing their own food, catching their own fish, and making things with their own hands. The Maine state motto is Dirigo, a Latin word that means I lead. And even after more than 200 years, that expression of independence and agency feels like a good fit for Maine. Today on Common Ground Radio, we'll be discussing the practice of homesteading, a way of life that offers both self-reliance and significant challenges. We'll learn about the history of homesteading and the practice of homesteading today, and we'll talk about the perennial appeal of doing it yourself and being self-sufficient. I'm Timothy Boston, your host for a conversation about local food and organic agriculture, brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Today's guests are Courtney Collum and Davis Taylor, both of whom have taught a course on homesteading at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, where they work as faculty. Courtney earned her PhD in anthropology and environmental policy from the University of Maine, and she is involved with several organizations in her community that support access to healthy food. Davis Taylor earned his PhD in economics from the University of Oregon, and his community involvement has included time serving on the policy committee for the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Timothy. It's great to be here.
So Maine has been a destination for homesteading since at least the 1970s. People like Scott and Helen Nearing influenced a generation with their choice to live the good life and get back to the land. Our listeners might already be familiar with the Nearings, but Scott and Helen weren't the first homesteaders. Who were the first homesteaders, and when did homesteading get started?
Well, I can start with that one. It would be hard to say when there was the first homesteaders. Obviously, in American history, people have gone out and raised their own food, made their own clothes, and created their own life in a homesteading sort of environment. But of course, most of that was born out of necessity of one sort or another. You could sort of say that homesteading really started to become something that is similar to what the Nearings were talking about, probably in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when people began to realize that industrialization was fundamentally changing the way Americans lived, and there was a sense of being called back to the land. There was also sufficient affluence in the United States to do such a thing, and people began to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't just jump aboard industrialization, jump aboard industrial farming. Let's see if we can find a way to go back to some sort of purer, simpler life. And that, you could say, is kind of when homesteading was born in the United States.
Yeah, I would add that I think, you know, when Davis and I taught the class on homesteading at College of the Atlantic a few years ago, part of the fun of it was, you know, debating, like raising questions about homesteading and debating it as a group. And, you know, I think the conclusion we came to with a lot of students in the class and with a lot of the homesteads we visited is that, you know, sometimes when people say homesteading, they mean different things. There are different ways you can think about it. You know, you can think about the Homestead Act of 1862 and the wave of homesteading that came about through that policy and, you know, people getting that 160 acres and going off to live on and improve the land. And by that metric, you know, I think when we focus on Maine, there has traditionally been a pretty homogenous definition of homesteading in Maine, pretty white. But like going back to the Homesteading Act, you know, there's a really interesting book that came out by genealogist Bernice Alexander Bennett in 2022, I think, called Black Homesteaders of the South. That looks at, you know, the 30 states where the Homestead Act existed, you know, genealogically tracing Black homesteaders in all of those places. That story is often seen as separate when we think about homesteading now. And I think in particular in Maine, we tend to think about the Nearings. But in the class, we tended to think of homesteading as being about choice, you know, choice being a significant part of what defines homesteading, you know, people choosing to make home the center of life in all ways, socially, economically, spiritually.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. You mentioned the Nearings. You mentioned the time period around the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, these ideas of choice, of rejecting certain ways of living. I wonder if there were other things that you talked about in terms of what motivates people to get back to the land. Some people might think of this as like giving up a modern way of living. Are these folks, are they obsessed with something in the past? Are they trying to go back in time? Why would somebody want to give up their modern conveniences?
Well, in terms of making this, what could be a pretty big leap, we're varied, but what our research tended to indicate and what the literature in this field discusses is sort of a spiritual conversion, a desire to become integrated more with nature. It's important to recognize that any acts of homesteading is partial acts. People cannot really completely separate themselves from markets and from mainstream production, but there's various degrees and various practices that they can engage in that will remove them to some degree from mainstream economic activity and allow them to or create the sort of cultural space for growing food, for building their own homes, for perhaps producing their own clothing, things of that nature. The literature tends to really focus, again, on people's internal motivations, a desire to get closer to nature, a desire for self-cultivation, making home the center of life, working on nature's terms, nature as the ultimate source of meaning, and really just invoking a deep spiritual dimension. I think on top of that, in my experience, there's also an important social element too. The relationships you have with other people when you're homesteading are pretty different than just sort of the casual marketplace interactions that you might have with people as you're buying food or something like that.
Yeah, and I would say we found that the themes that Davis named, those themes of what motivates homesteading, we found, you know, what we were reading in historical books, you know, like about, you know, Rebecca Neal Gould's book, At Home in Nature, and the Nearings. You know, those all talked about those motivations of like wanting to find meaning, wanting to build an intentional life, wanting to focus more on production than consumption, really rejecting consumer culture. We found that historically, but we also found it in the, you know, in the homesteads we visited. We visited a lot of homesteads in the class and they were all really different. You know, as Davis said, we didn't visit a single homestead that was completely separated from economic markets. You know, that in some places people were really focused on food production, but, you know, they were buying in clothes and buying in wood. In other places, there was very little food production, which was surprising, but they were really committed to building their own structures and harvesting their own timber and making and mending their own clothes. It was sort of like everyone had a different passion and limited energy, right? And they were putting it where they were most interested. But the theme that came up again and again with the folks we talked to was that it was about meaning. It was about feeling like it's hard in contemporary life to live intentionally and mindfully and with meaning. And people were seeking that. They were wanting to be really intentional. They were wanting to live and practice their values.
So I'm hearing that there's no one single definition, no one single way to do homesteading. And people's motivations vary. People's practices vary. Of course, we're having this conversation in Maine. You two both work at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, which is a beautiful setting. We're closer to nature than people are in lots of other parts of the country or parts of the world. I wonder if in your visits to homesteads or in your study of the subject, is there something special about the state of Maine that draws people here?
I think the community connection, for one. I mean, Maine's sort of an interesting place. The way religion has developed here over time is different than it is in the rest of the country. There's always been a real sense of like self-sufficiency and Yankee ingenuity and do it yourself. I was just reading a couple of months ago about, you know, the very first food security laws in Maine. And even at that time, like this was like maybe 1700. And the article I was arguing was like, even at that time, you know, we were part of Northern Massachusetts, but we were still so different from Southern Massachusetts. Like there was just this mentality of like, it's really hard up here. It's really tough to survive. We will take and we will accept anyone as long as you do the work. Like that was the essence of what I was reading is like, we don't care what your religion is. Like, come on up. We just need people to help harvest wood. We need people to help grow food. And I think that does kind of show up in the way Maine is now. And I think that's kind of what attracts people here is we have the natural resources. you know, certainly, I think we did, we'd have to look at the stats on this, but I think we did notice homesteaders kind of popping up in towns with like less strict building codes, right? Like lower taxes, like really looking for land where they could build these funky structures that they wanted without a lot of oversight, but they could also find other people doing that, that they could do it in community with. I know Davis has been really interested in that, the community piece of homesteading.
Another element was simply inexpensive land. There's, of course, some large-scale agriculture in Maine, but the landscape, the condition of the soils and so on and so forth is much different from other parts of the country. So smaller parcels of land, they're going to be less expensive for people to obtain, was definitely an attraction. We talked to some people who are homesteading in Gouldsboro, and they basically said, yeah, in the 60s and 70s, we heard that east of Ellsworth was where you go for really inexpensive land. And you could argue that that's still the case today, that compared to other parts of the country and even to southern Maine, Hancock County and particular parts of Hancock County are just magnets for people who don't have a lot of money, want to be able to produce their own food, and they can get land here and start that process out.
So we've talked a bit already about Helen and Scott Nearing, and I understand that one of the things that was important to them was the way in which they practiced agriculture. And I wonder if there's anything in your findings that connects homesteading and the organic movement.
In Gouldsboro, Irene Cotroisi and John Archer's place really sort of exemplifies a permaculture element or a permaculture approach to producing food. And I would say that was pretty much, well, as Courtney said, there were a few places that didn't really seem to emphasize much food production at all, but the places where food was central, it was definitely a permaculture approach, no use of any kind of non-organic supplements that I can recall, and an attitude that they wanted to work with the land, work around the land within the contours of very small spaces usually. And the growing conditions in Maine, as your listeners know, is such that you have to really be smart. You have to use your intelligence. The land will produce bountifully if you know what you're doing. And so there was a sense of really trying to work with the land, learn from the land, treat every square yard as a separate sort of ecosystem practically. Soil conservation, obviously something super important. Those were the themes that really struck me.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to Common Ground Fair in September, just the number of homesteading booths and homesteading information, there's a clear connection, right, between just the interest in getting away from pesticides, reducing inputs, working with nature, like relying on traditional ecological knowledge. Like that certainly popped up in a lot of the homesteads we visited and read about. I think the most interesting theme that kept popping up for students is going into the course, there was a question of like, how can homesteaders survive based, you know, working on primarily from home, right? How can you afford it in this day and age? You know, there's this, in the past, there was this, it was traditionally cheaper perhaps to grow your own food. And that's just not always the case now. You know, there's a certain level of privilege or social capital you have to succeed in homesteading now. You have to have access to land if you're doing it in the United States, where we primarily have private property, right? Like you have to have access to the tools, and you're relying a lot on your own labor and your sweat equity, but there are costs to getting into it. And the thing that came up at every homestead we visited was, it's not about how much you make, it's about how much you spend. Don't spend money. Like that was what homesteaders told us over and over again. Don't spend money. You do it yourself. You rely on gift economies, you borrow, you barter, you go to seed swaps, and you trade plants, and you mend. And I think that showed up in food as well, right? Like part of it is a care for the earth and a concern for human health and community health. You know, that motivated people to be using permaculture or growing organically. But it was also like, why would we pay for fertilizer? Why would we pay for pesticides? And we have the time and we have our own labor and our own knowledge to be able to go out there and pick cucumber beetles and, you know, really invest in building soil.
I would add also, I'm thinking about this a little bit, there was a strong sense and willingness to experiment. people were raising ducks in greenhouses to see if the pond bed could then be used as a super organic material for spreading on fields. We visited one place where they had some pretty wet soil, and they were figuring out how they could do raised beds and doing really some cool stuff with raised beds to try to overcome that. And everywhere we went, people were just saying, well, we tried this, we heard about that, so we did it here, but it didn't quite work. So that seemed to be really a part of the process too.
You are listening to Common Ground Radio on WERU Community Radio. On today's show, we are talking about homesteading, and my guests are Courtney Collum and Davis Taylor, who both have taught a course on homesteading at the College of the Atlantic. Common Ground Radio can be heard on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on 89.9 FM and at weru.org. We've talked a bit about what motivates people to take a try at homesteading, some of the challenges that are confronting homesteaders. And we've also mentioned these very influential figures, Helen and Scott Nearing, who inspired a lot of people to come to a place like Maine to try homesteading. The Nearings both came from families where they enjoyed a lot of privilege. Of course, they lived a simple life, and that was part of their message. Davis, you touched on it a little bit already, but do you have to be rich to live as a homesteader?
I would guess that the average amount of family wealth within homesteaders, and by which I mean someone's parents or grandparents might have the wealth to sort of create a bit of an economic backstop, it's probably a little bit higher than you would find across the average of the United States. But you also have people coming in with hardly two coins to rub together, who purposefully sort of eschew their family's money and ways of that they could be making money. They tend to, you know, they're sort of this almost cliche version of people coming up to Maine in a Volkswagen van and finding some land and living hand to mouth for a couple of years before they really can establish themselves. And I think there's some truth to that sort of version of things. So I think there's privilege in the sense that usually there's some sort of backstop somewhere within the family and there's sort of also a cultural awareness of how to do this. And if it doesn't work out, you can go someplace else. But at the same time, people oftentimes start with almost next to nothing in terms of their immediate possessions and wealth.
Given what we've talked about in terms of some of the backgrounds that folks are coming from and maybe the way that the conditions that they're entering in have changed over time, I wonder, in your visits, how homesteading has seemed like a viable lifestyle in 2025 in such a technologically connected era. How viable of a lifestyle is it to do it yourself and be a homesteader?
My sense is it's become harder in some ways, you know, more expensive. Land is expensive. You know, as we said, you need to either be able to afford the tools you need to be self-sufficient, or you need to inherit them or have the friend networks, the social capital to get access to those, or you just need to be real hardcore and fierce and find them wherever you can, right? But I also think the world is just so precarious. I mean, this is something Davis and I talk about, right? Like, economically, people who are working full-time jobs are struggling to make it in this economy. People who are working more than full-time jobs are struggling to make it in this economy. So I think that's where the motivation of like building a life with meaning really comes into place, is I think a lot of people, especially a lot of young people we work with at the college, look at it and it's like, okay, I can work 60 hours a week and barely afford rent and I'm never going to have the possibility of buying a home, and I can dedicate all of my life to that work, or I can do work that's really, really meaningful to me. I can spend less, you know, really resist consumer culture, just buy less and live simply, but be enjoying my time, have time for my passions, whatever those are, you know, whether it's gardening and things that can actually help me with self-sufficiency, but also time to make music and time to make art and time to read and time to dedicate to my community and contribute to a community center and cultural events. I think that's a choice a lot of people are making. It's, you know, it's an economically precarious world. It's going to be. So I, I might as well live the way I want to live.
I'm really fascinated and intrigued by the influence of Instagram and YouTube on potential homesteaders. There's lots and lots of YouTube channels that focus on, or feature people who are out doing what we would consider homestead activities. But the fundamental ethic of homesteading is to move away from markets. And Instagram and YouTube seek to marketize homesteading. So you have this real irony and paradox that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But at the same time, the sort of the heightened cultural awareness of these things, or at least their accessibility on social media, may make it easier for people, may make it easier for them to say, oh, I could do that. And look, they're milking a cow. They're raising chickens. I could do that too. I wonder if it also makes it easier to treat it somewhat superficially, to say, okay, I'm going to just, you know, go off and do this and try it for 6 months. They might think they're going to try it for 6 months, but I wonder if they would have the same dedication and stick-to-itness as people did in the 60s and 70s. So I think it's a really interesting time to be thinking about homesteading. I'll be curious to see what happens in the next few years. We can look at the economy over the past couple of years and say that it's been turbulent. We can look at how things have been in the past few months and say that things have been quite turbulent. And there's times when people feel like they're losing hope in larger scale society. They will seek to find hope at a smaller scale, find control and autonomy and the ability to steer things at a smaller scale, and homesteading could serve that purpose. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how people are reacting to contemporary issues and see if there's sort of an uptick in back to the land, while at the same time having all these distractions and having it sort of just being a focus of social media. That will be interesting too.
Another theme that came up when we were visiting homesteads is, what do you do about health insurance? It's hard to age as a homesteader, right? In a country without universal health care. So many homesteads, someone's working off the homestead, right? Someone's having to bring in some extra income or be the person to provide insurance for the group. And I think that's where YouTube and social media become really interesting for people is, you know, that's a way you can be making some extra income is by marketing what you're doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You're talking about social media, this, of course, particular moment in history, which is perhaps very different from other times when people were seeking out homesteading as a lifestyle. Courtney, you mentioned the economic conditions that your students are looking at and making decisions about their lives and their lifestyle. I wonder in teaching this class and then in visiting homesteads and giving students a real hands-on perspective, I wonder if any of them have become inspired to try out homesteading themselves.
Absolutely. I think we, College of the Atlantic, we also attract people who are interested in homesteading anyway. You know, we have a fair number of students who grew up on homesteads or, you know, just were really active gardeners were brought up in community. But yeah, definitely. I think a lot of young people today are just looking at the world and they're wanting to build a purposeful, meaningful life. And they're looking at the economic possibilities and it. There's not a lot of promise there. You know, it's not like the old promise of you work hard and you'll be rewarded. And I do think that makes homesteading look more compelling. Take some control of your own destiny. What do you think, Davis?
I don't think we've tracked the people who took the course and what they're doing now. I don't recall anybody when we, at the end of the course, saying, I'm going to go homestead because of this. But I think just about everybody was saying, all the students were saying, I'm going to do something like what they're doing. I'm going to incorporate some kind of self-production in my life. I'm going to gardening, tapping maple, any kind of thing like that. I'd be really surprised if most of the students were not doing some sorts of homesteading elements in their life. Probably there's some who moved to cities, might make it a little bit hard, but even a little bit of urban gardening or something like that, probably. They seem to really grasp that this was something that was within their realm of possibility, and going full homestead might be kind of hard. Definitely incorporating some practices is something that they want to do.
So we started this conversation talking about Maine as a place where people are self-reliant, and we didn't quite decide on a definition of homesteading, but sort of concluded that it has to do with people's desire to do it themselves, to resist a market economy. And you two, of course, have taught a course on this. And I wonder if there are ways in which you and your personal lives have taken up some of these practices, or you're producing things yourself, or existing outside of the market economy.
At one point, I had planned to really become actively engaged in homesteading, but my life sort of took some different turns. And this is something that we found within the homesteaders we visited. I think today, several years later, relationships have changed. People have moved a little bit here and there. Some people are still doing exactly or the same degree of homesteading that they were doing before, but it's pretty easy to have other elements of your life sort of distract you or pull you away. And that's kind of what happened to me. But I still cut a lot of my own firewood and use firewood principally as heating. I will have a garden this summer and not grow a heck of a lot of my own food, but definitely make it an activity. For me, homesteading was really about how I got out into the land and felt soil and felt sweat and black flies and all those sorts of things. And that's something you can do with just, you know, cutting firewood or a little bit of gardening or something like that. So that was kind of my background.
What about you, Courtney?
Yeah, I am not a homesteader. I would not call myself a homesteader, but someone who greatly admires it and aspires to it. I think it will, you know, it takes time. It takes time. It takes skill. It takes knowledge. And just the way I've built my professional life doesn't create a lot of time to do all of those things. But my interest in teaching the class with Davis definitely came from my interest in food production. You know, huge gardener, grow as much food as I can, put as much of that food by. I grew up in a family of hunters and am fortunate to have a father who lives nearby who can put a couple of deer in the freezer and a couple of turkeys in the freezer for us. And, you know, we've got most of our meat for the year. So that is what I lean on now. But I come back to these questions all the time of like, what kind of choices are we making for our own lives? And are we getting the satisfaction and gratification we want from our lives? Or can we bring it closer to home and, you know, do more quilt making, clothes mending, things that bring us real pleasure and value? And yeah, I'm trying to make that space in my life.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate having you both on today. And thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been Common Ground Radio, which airs on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM. Archives of previous episodes can be found on weru.org, as well as the WERU app. I'd like to thank Courtney Collum and Davis Taylor of the College of the Atlantic for joining me today. I'd also like to thank the show's editor, Claire Boland. Stay tuned for more great programming.